Herzlich willkommen, liebe Zuhörenden von Popkunstseele. Schön, dass ihr da seid. Wir melden uns das erste Mal nach der Sommerpause wieder. Hier ist Gofi und hier ist eigentlich fast nur Gofi. Jay und Marco sind noch in der Sommerpause. Die werden erst am 1. September wieder für euch zurückkommen. Ich bin nicht alleine. Ich bin zusammen mit Ben hier vor Kamera und Mikrofon. Aber ihr werdet ihn gleich noch ein bisschen besser kennenlernen. Ich hoffe sehr, dass ihr schöne Wochen hinter euch habt, wo ihr ein bisschen euch erholen konntet. Ich hoffe, ihr habt vor der Hitze fliehen können, wenn es sehr heiß war. Ich kann das alles gerade noch nicht wissen, weil wir nehmen das gerade noch vor der Sommerpause auf. Aber ihr hört das jetzt erst heute, frühestens am 18. August. Ja, schön, dass ihr wieder da seid. Wir haben uns spannende Themen für die nächsten Wochen und Monate überlegt. Und wir beginnen heute mit Ben Giancarelli, with the painter Ben Giancarelli. Hello, Ben.
Hi. Hi,
great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Did you tell everybody it's going to be in English?
No, I didn't. Liebe Zuhörerinnen, das stimmt. Dieses Gespräch wird auf Englisch stattfinden, weil Ben spricht am besten Englisch. Und wir trauen euch einfach mal zu, dass ihr das understanden könnt, verstehen könnt. Wir haben das ja schon mal gemacht, Anfang des Jahres mit der Heidi Joubert. Und jetzt machen wir das ein zweites Mal mit Ben. Okay, Ben, you are here. Thank you for coming to
Popkunstseele.
Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed you changed your name since last we spoke.
Yeah, we did, because we thought that Cobain's Heirs is somewhat cool name, but nobody can understand what this is all about. So we had people thinking this is about music or whatever, you know, and we just wanted a very, well, very obvious name to know what this is all about pop, about art, and about, you know, spirituality or whatever, all things that makes life good. When this comes out, it will be August 18, but today, as we are recording this, it's the 4th of July.
Woo!
Independence Day.
Yeah, and it's you know,
Is that a big deal for you as an American?
I think for a lot of Americans, it's a big deal. I've been here. This is my 10th, 4th of July in Germany.
Uh-huh.
Never was a big person. I don't like fireworks. So spending outside in the hottest days of the year, barbecuing always felt a bit insane to me. so the fun bits weren't really my thing. I do like barbecuing, but, you know, not when it's 40 Celsius and 100% humidity. Because where I come from, the northeast of the U.S., Providence, Rhode Island, which is sort of between Boston and New York, this time of year, even long time residents of very hot areas are horrified by the weather. It's my favorite description was a friend of mine who came from California getting off the plane for the first time in middle of July, and she's just like, the air is touching me and I don't like that. And
is touching me.
And it's not like a hi, it's more of a how you doing, bro? like an overbearing aunt who's wrapping you up in a wool blanket, but the blanket is also in your lungs is sort of the feeling. And that was one of the things I liked about Germany for a while was that the summers weren't awful, and I didn't need air conditioning. And
yeah, right. But are you missing it? You know, celebrating the 4th of July, everything, independence,
whatever. Not at all. No. No. Because, I mean, I left in 2015, and so I left for, you know, because it was obvious to me that the state was collapsing, and people thought I was completely crazy. So it felt a bit obscene to celebrate, you know, the creation of a democracy that was being systemically, you know, dismantled. And I mean, you know, and then this doesn't even get into the systemic inequalities that have existed throughout the entire, you know, the entire existence when runtime of my country. I don't miss 4th of July.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, this is probably the hardest and saddest 4th of July, because so many of the friends and family are terrified of what's coming. And, and it feels, you know, it feels a little bit like, it feels a little bit like maybe this is the last one for a lot of people.
Do you still have many contacts in the US? Are you, you know, calling, speaking to each other?
I mean,
regularly.
You know, my circle of friends is pretty neurodiverse. So we've been texting more than we ever videoed or called for you know, decades at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the few people who prefers face to face, voice to voice contact. And so it makes it a little bit tough for me because I would much rather, you know, have a phone call or you know, in person meeting. And a lot of my friends, it'll take them a week, month. Yeah. A year to reply to a text.
Okay.
And the last thing I want to do is have them feel worse for how long it takes them to get the spoons to be able to reply. But the people I am in touch with are terrified, angry, ready to do more than I think people realize. I mean, this is I mean, you know how things are here. I mean, the people are also being disappeared. You know, there's also warmongers telling us that if we don't support war, we're racist and anti-Semitic. All of this stuff, mm-hmm. and the majority of the people are against this stuff. But the people in power think that they have the moral and ethical high ground when all they're doing is just selling death to everybody for money.
And now, how do you feel watching all this from a safe distance and away from Germany? How are your feelings right now?
Well, I've said this for about 10 years, that it feels weird to have survivor's guilt while people are still alive.
Okay.
It feels weird to be removed from that. I mean, I came here and stepped into something that completely destroyed me and took everything I had away, but I don't have to worry about the things that my kids would have to worry about if I was, you know, queer, black, Latino, you know, any sort of immigrant in the U.S., even as an immigrant here, because I'm white, you know, I'm white and I have a German family, so I fly under the radar. It's horrible. But you know, you have to keep going. You can't. There's just how many times can you just watch bodies in the rubble? And I mean, of course, part of that system is designed to make us all just, you know, put that in the same category as we put, you know, girls dancing, mm-hmm. And true. so that we, you know, we make camps and fan bases and base our identity around. You know, around whether we support the horrors or deny the horrors. And at a certain point, you have to kind of box it up and go, what can I, you know, what sort of actionable things can I do? And
in order to survive, right? I mean, psychologically as well.
Yeah,
otherwise, to stay sane in a way.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever passes sane for sane as an artist, yeah.
Yeah. Let's step back a little bit because not everybody knows who you are and what you do and everything. You are a painter, you are a musician, a video artist. That's right.
I mean, musician's a bit...
That's a long time ago.
Well, it's a bit of a glow up, I would say, of what I did. I've been making music and noise and experimental audio... sort of never at the same time, or very rarely at the same time since 96, 97. And so, you know, we're coming up on 30 years, which is a lot. I would say primarily I'm a performance artist, a performer, not a performance artist. Everything I do from painting to audio to, you know, even the ridiculous screeds I post on Facebook, are all part of a, you know, long-term narrative that I've been working on for decades.
So you would say this is all one big project?
Yeah.
Everything you do?
Yeah, everything. And I've been working the past year on sort of projects that pull those threads together, using things that I wrote when I was 18, and working on projects that I, you know, literally working on right now, including stuff from when I was 18, which is something I never did before. I always made a point of never reusing media, never reusing old stuff, never visiting the past. But as much as I generate new material, at a certain point, I realized I have to show that's the one thing that kind of getting into visual arts showed me that it was failing at was showing the thread. It always, for a lot of uneducated people, especially like the art critics, like the local art critics think that they have some idea of what art is, and really what they know is what was art when they were 20, you know.
Okay.
And they haven't had any sort of feedback or updates or any pushback in 30 years, and they're all, you know, aged out of being good writers, but they, you know, they exist for a certain audience who still kisses their ass, and they, you know, they think they're tastemakers when it's like, okay, yeah, well, your audience is 5,000 people who are half dead. So
I want to explore this further later on, but give us some bullet points about you. I mean, you live in Germany.
Sure.
Between Hanau and Aschaffenburg, right? Little town there.
It's more between Dieburg and Aschaffenburg, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's on the off of the. It's great because it's the road, the 26 connects between connects Dieburg to Aschaffenburg, Darmstadt and Aschaffenburg rather.
Yeah.
Darmstadt to Aschaffenburg, I'm closer to the Aschaffenburg side of things, but I'm also near the A3 pickup, so that means I'm 15 minutes outside my studio in Frankfurt. And today, because it's been 500 degrees Celsius in the studios in Frankfurt, I'm in my home where it's nice and cool.
But usually you would be at your studio right now.
Yeah. I do most of my video work at home just because it's easier. To have a separation of concerns where video and coding stuff can stay here, and also have more room to spread out, which is a problem for my wife and kids. I have more room to spread out here, and then I try to keep painting and displayed digital works at the studio.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're married to Uli. You have two kids.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's what you said already.
Should I do a just little hi? I'm so and so.
No. We collect this on the way. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yeah. So I've been married for 21 years. Coming up this August.
Yeah.
We have three kids.
Three kids. Sorry.
Yeah, three kids. The oldest is 14. The youngest is 10. And the middle is just turned 12. They're all very talented, interesting children. My oldest just self-published their first manga, and it sold all the copies sold out immediately, which was, you know, a joke that she made more money than I did this month in art. The all three kids are really, you know, sort of fascinating, interesting beings of their own, but they also, you can instantly see how they're shaped by our genetics and personalities.
Yeah. So you are in Germany since 2015, right? You and Uli, you both came to Germany. You lived in the States, but you came to Germany because Uli had, I guess, relatives here in Germany, right?
We came to visit after our youngest, who was a surprise kid, was born. Originally, the plan was that because we had kids, it was hard to travel. Very young kids. The kids were all very close in age. The original plan was that Willie's father and grandmother would come visit. But her grandmother realized that a 9-hour travel time was too much. And so she paid for first Uli and the kids to come visit. And then I was working as an engineer at the time. So I didn't have a lot of vacation time because I just started my job a few months before. And then I came to visit and, their family lives near Trier in wine country, it was really beautiful there. And as we came, things were really bad at my job. Uli's job, Uli was being very badly abused at the university she was working at for having dared to have another child. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that in America, you don't get guaranteed family time. She went to work. She went back to work, I think, 3 weeks after Jamie was born. She was working full time, basically, after the baby was born.
Wow.
And I mean, luckily she had summer break, but the summer breaks were only 6 or 7 weeks of downtime. And then we had kids at home. And at the same time, I knew Trump was going to be president. This was 2015, right as soon as he got the Republican nomination, I said that it didn't matter whether he was going to be president or just a disruptive force. And I hadn't at that point realized how much the Clinton legacy had collapsed the middle class, but I also knew that Democrats were basically dead set on doing nothing to push back against the rise of the far right. I mean, obviously they were benefiting from having a boogeyman to be afraid of, because, you know, that's what they do. Mm. And so, yeah, we came here and I realized that there was no life for us in the States anymore. Our daycare per kid was, I think, $2,000 a month. So we were looking at a $6,000, you know, somewhere between $4,000 and $6,000 a month, just daycare bill, just to be able to go work. Sure. I was an electrical engineer. My wife was a professor and we were ending up $500 in the minus more every month from just daycare. And, mm-hmm. All of these factors sort of just piled up and piled up and piled up. And then we looked at what Hartsfield would pay if we never could get jobs. And we said, oh, that's the same take home every month as we're making, working 60, 70, 80 hours a week plus kids. And so we came here in 2015, and people thought we were absolutely insane for leaving America.
Yeah.
It took several years before people started taking us a little bit more seriously.
Yeah, right. So you're looking back on 10 years in Germany.
Almost 11, yeah.
Almost 11.
Yeah.
How does it work out for you so far being an artist in Germany? What would you say? Is it good? Do you feel successful in a way?
Well, it's interesting because by every metric for the resources I've been given, for the resources that I had when I started doing this, and for the reason I started the art thing at all, I've done phenomenally well. I mean, the past year and a half has been a little bit tough in terms of sales, but that's the same with everybody else. But yeah. the first 3 years that I did this, it was just, you know, endless exhibitions, lots of opportunities. I had to at the time stay basically in Frankfurt or Aschaffenburg or Darmstadt because of the kids. That's changed just in the past year, actually. The kids are all stable now. And so, you know, things are in motion for not being so Hessen bound. But the art scene, which has a reputation for being very exclusive and very exclusionary, has been very, at the level I operate at anyway, has been very open, very, very kind and very understanding of my work. There are useless people who are also gatekeepers, but those people, you know, have successfully generally gatekept themselves into irrelevance at this point. But the majority of venues that I've operated at, the people I've worked with have all been very, very kind and you know, very supportive of my work. And so that's been a bonus. I mean, ultimately would I have rather stayed as an engineer and made a ton of money and been making cool shit? Yeah. but I'm kind of starting to incorporate that side of my brain back into my art again, because I spent so long focused on just paint because I needed to learn really how to paint.
Like, yeah.
Not just paint, but how to paint. How to treat the creation of paint as another material science project. Yeah, and so I spent many years just doing that and hundreds of paintings. But even while I was still figuring things out, and while I had only been painting for a couple of years, people were very open and accepting, and in a way that I don't think that a bigger scene would have been, you know, available to me. I had access to some pretty important events in my life because of that. So I'm grateful to that. Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah.
I came across some. I mean, I know I know many of your paintings. Obviously, I don't know all of them. You said it. You painted a lot of them, but I know some of your work, of your paintings, and I like them. I love them, actually. But I came across some sound creations as well. I watched some videos you did. So you work with you know, different materials in a way. You work with paint, you know, with color, shape, words. I mean, language. That's mm-hmm. There's always words in your paintings as well, or mostly. Many times. Yeah.
This is the only one that has words on these four. These, by the way, this is for context. This is my this is our living room or our dining room.
Okay. Yeah. But then sound as well, right? Mm-hmm. And then video. I mean footage. You find and you work with it. You change it. You distort it. So there's. I mean, from different realms of reality, so to say, you gather you collect your material and work with it, right? Mm-hmm. So it and you create something new out of it. Is that right?
Sure. So I think the best way to talk about that is to talk about the different ways that I work in each genre or each medium, I guess. So paint is obviously very immediate and physical. You know, you throw some color on a canvas, you see the result, and then you react to that. Audio is either something that you wait a second for a computer to generate some noise pattern, or mm-hmm. you make the sounds yourself, or you have a synthesizer, drum machine, something like that, and then you work with what you have there, or you layer on top of that. Video is a very, very different thing in terms of delay, because there's no real time video creation in my sort of wheelhouse. I'm not a live video person. I don't do VJ or anything like that. So video is the only thing that I work in that isn't immediate feedback, isn't immediate payoff. I mean, obviously I see the current frame that I'm working on, but some of the video projects or the animation projects I do will take, you know, one frame, 20 minutes to render. And so then I have to work in a very sort of different process in that way. But the common thread through all of this is my improvisational background, in terms of having, you know, originally been a theater brat and got in, you know, being obsessed with improv and improvisational music and basically anything I could get my hands on, or be any sphere I could be accepted where there wasn't planning involved. Everything I did, everything except for slam poetry, or rap battles, or anything that was that level of improv. I was obsessed with this thing of the human brain as a random number generator, basically. Everything that I've ever done has been about that we don't need pre-planning, we don't need anything said in advance. We have all the seeds for, you know, an infinite number of creations within us. We don't have to jury ourselves, we don't have to agonize over something. We just work on the feedback. And so for a lot of people, they have this fear of, you know, the blank page or a newly opened DAW at DAW, or, you know, an empty canvas. And for me, it's just like, just do something, you know.
You don't have that, this never. Fear of the blank page. You don't
never, 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 never. What can really drag me down is when I have too many open projects and that are from different sort of moments. And I start to getting thick in terms of what should go next, where, because the freshness of a new canvas is an invitation to do anything. Whereas if you have something that you really like and you're working completely improvisationally, you have to be open to the fact that you might just paint over that thing completely. But at the same time, you have to have a curatorial eye on your own work, saying like, is this just the impulse to, is this actually the impulse to fix this? Or is this the impulse to just get it over with and call it, you know, call it complete? And, yeah. and balancing that, that's the sort of common thread through my art, my visual art, my music and video is I want to keep that rawness. I want to keep that unplanned nature. But at the same time, I want to be able to say to myself, this is done.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of thread of, there's no fear of starting something new. Mm-hmm. There's no fear of ending something when it's sufficiently done. But mm-hmm. but that middle ground of, am I just being lazy or is this actually done? Is the only part where I really struggle.
And okay,
but I think that's why people respond to my work because, I mean, there's just this constant interplay between, you know, rawness and doneness.
Right. Do you have a ritual when you stand in front of an empty canvas? Is there something you do every time because it gets you going?
No. It depends on the weather, literally the weather. Depends on the mood that I'm in. This was something I think, even though I only did theater in high school and like 2 or 3 years in college, this was something that was really cooked into theater kids that really changed how my brain worked from a very young age of the show must go on. And there's no excuse that, you know, if you're part of a thing, you do your part of the thing unless you literally have a broken leg. And okay. so when I get to a point where I'm in the space where I have time and energy to create, which, you know, with kids and you know, organizing shows and stuff that can be really tough. There's no excuse for not doing the thing. Where I get stuck is that sometimes I will forget that I'm there to do that, and I will, you know, get on the phone and start posting on Insta or, that is a recent development, and I'm not really, really proud of that change. It's not something I really want to have as part of my life, but I would say that I think for a lot of us, Corona broke our relationship with screens. Mm. So in terms of ritual, I think the most important part of my creative process is just like when you're tripping on acid or something, it's set and setting, you know, is to make sure that you are in the space that is the most comfortable for you at that moment. There's no perfect, like, okay, I have to wait until the stars line. It's like, okay, this is the environment I have. Hmm. At least center myself, at least get, you know, make sure my materials are ready so that I don't have to go digging through stuff if I have this space, or what materials do I have ready if I don't have the energy to go digging through stuff.
Yeah.
What can I do with what I have? And that's the important bit is what can I do with what I have? And that I think is not just the ritual is also the common thread through my work of just use what you have.
Okay.
And
just use what you have. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. So what is a good environment for you to work? What kind of, I don't know, atmosphere, situation?
In terms of painting or audio?
Yeah, in terms of any artistic endeavor, but maybe, I mean, we are talking about painting
mostly
right now. I mean, what do you need to paint to feel good or to feel comfortable when painting?
I know that I had a situation last year where my studio was under someone who's very sound sensitive, next to someone who's very sound sensitive, and across the hall from someone who's very sound sensitive.
Yeah.
And they were all conservative, older German women who have been making conservative, older German women's influenced art for 50 years, 30, 40 years.
And you like to listen to loud music when you
listen
work,
to
right?
music, not like I have it. You know, I have speakers that have boxes that are this big, you know, and I had them acoustically decoupled from the wall and you know, like made it so that I could hear it loud enough because headphones are too, they're too much when you're painting because I need to be able to move it. I need also feeling this, hearing the music in the space is life. You know, and so I need music to really get high energy pieces going. But I realize I can paint pretty well without music, but what I can't have is aggressive interruption? Is someone thinking, well, you're breaking this social rule that I've decided is appropriate. Meanwhile, I've checked the laws, I've checked the building regulations, I've checked with the administration of the building several times. Yeah. I'm all within compliance, but these people decide that they get to set the standard for what their comfort should be. Never mind that it's an industrial building, whatever, you know. That was the deal breaker for me, was realizing that there could be people who just decide that they have access to my time.
Sounds very German to me.
I think that's the definition of busybody German is someone who decides that their ideas matter more than your privacy, more than your sanity, that you've violated some social code that only they know about, but you should know because they know it.
Right.
So, clear expectations of knowing that I'm in a space where I can do the thing that I need to do, which sometimes, not always, but sometimes involves, you know, loud music, to cover up the fact that I'm singing along to the loud music.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm finally at the point where I can kind of say that I have a pretty decent singing voice. I've been doing it for 30 years. I actually just stumbled across a recording I made while I was learning my newer style of singing, where I was more aggressive and more, you know, kind of focus on a more nasal thing. The thing that would influence the band that I was in with my wife 2 years later, and it was amazing to hear how I couldn't sing. And then six months later, I'm recording with a band, and everybody likes my voice. But just, you know, those documentation of the past is so fascinating to me right now. I've never done this before.
But that's really interesting, because you did sing, you know, you did it, and you were learning while doing it. And you just some minutes ago, you said the same about painting. You know, you painted lots and lots of pictures, and you learned, by the way, how to use paint, how to do it in a way. Is that right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's some sort of exploration. You're kind of making art. You don't wait until you master all the techniques and then you go into the thing you create. But this creating of art in your situation is learning at the same time, how to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the only way to do it if you want to. Anybody who thinks that they have to get good at something will never get good at something. You'll never, ever get good at something if you wait until you're good at something to do something. Because there was actually a great study done where it was called, I forget the name of the study. I'll send it to you later. But basically, it was two pottery classes. One was told to make as many as they could, just constantly make as many as they could. Yeah. And another, and submit all of them to the professor, and the professor would pick out from each class four masterpieces. And then the one class was told, make four masterpieces and just give us the four masterpieces. And the class that made a whole bunch didn't just make four masterpieces, they made 20.
Wow.
That were qualified as masterpieces, not just good, but like, you know, under these qualifications. And the class that made the four struggled, didn't quite do as well, because doing is making, and practicing and learning from your mistakes and recognizing that painting's not quite as quantifiable as making pottery. You know, you certainly see more obviously where you've failed in terms of materials with pottery than you can in painting, but the theory is the same. It's just you'd learn by doing, just doing and doing and doing and doing. You don't necessarily have to exhibit those first pieces, and you don't have to keep those first pieces, but you have to make them. You have to just keep doing it. Same thing with singing. You have to get up on stage and suck. Same thing with comedy. You have to be on stage and be awful for however long, and you have to own that. You can't be like, well, I'm going to get better. You might not get better. Fuck it. It doesn't matter. Oh, sorry. it doesn't matter if you get better. You won't get better until you do the thing, and you'll never learn how to get good at something in a class environment. You learn the ideas of the thing you're going to go do in the class environment.
Yeah.
But you don't learn the thing ever. Like engineering, science, math, all of this stuff is the same as art. You learn the basics, and then you take those basics and you experiment. If you're an engineer, you make different circuits that don't work for a long time. You find out why they don't work, and you use your tools to analyze. If you're a painter, you mess up and you make paints that crack because you've put acrylic on top of oil or stuff like that. But if you have learned the why in the class, then you can experiment with what are the rules and why are these rules and derive an internal model of how to make the thing that you're doing better versus my professor taught me this and this is going to be my identity for the next 30 years, which is the German artistic model of, I know people who are in their 70s that still put who they studied under when they were in college on their CV and you look at their work and it's like, okay, yeah, they've been doing that for 50 years. And it makes me insane because the only reason their professor had any influence on them was because their professor was famous. And the reason their professor was famous was probably because their professor was doing something unique. Mm-hmm. And so these academics latch onto this thing of, well, this is a working formula and we're going to sell this so you have a successful career. No, you're going to make shitty copies of shitty copies of shitty copies of shitty copies. Yeah. And then you're going to saturate the market. So any new ideas coming along or anybody just playing around is going to completely fall through the cracks in any medium.
So where are you heading to artistically? I mean, you said you are developing in a way, not really away from painting, right? You will go on painting.
Yeah.
But there are different projects right now you're working on.
Yeah. So I've been playing a lot with time. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you saw can I say shit?
No, you can curse all you want. Yeah.
Good.
No problem at all.
Good. I'm very good at cursing.
Yeah.
I've been playing with time. I don't know if I sent you the demo video of the self-portrait piece that I had made.
No.
Okay. I'll send that along. But I've been working on this self-portrait series. Series of modifications to a self-portrait.
Yeah.
And it's a minute and a half loop of me just mugging for the camera. And I did all sorts of crazy things to the foreground and background layers and made multiple variations. And so that it loops in a ping pong method. So it's, you know, it seamlessly loops so that you don't see where the loop point is generally. And it will loop forever, but no two iterations of the foreground, the forward and backward loop will ever be the same because it's got this random number generator that picks the foreground combination and the background combination. And so it would take 10 with 5,000 zeros after years for the sequence to repeat. So it's just an infinitely, you know, effectively infinite, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I can render out multiple versions of it, but the interesting bit is the fact that it's running live all the time on some piece of hardware. But if I run it live on two different pieces of hardware, we'll see the same frame, the same absolute frame for any of them at any given time, because I've synced the whole thing to the moment of my birth. But they will be showing a different variation of that same sequence. So a different foreground, different background, or maybe the same foreground and background for a few frames. And then they'll lose sync with each other. But I could have 100,000 of those things running and you'll never see the same combination at the same time, but they will all be synced without having a central server because we have access to atomic clocks. And so if you set the clock and say, I need this frame at this time relative to my start point, you can get pretty damn good accuracy. Now, obviously, there's a lot of slop with the software that I'm using. So there's a chance that every now and then will be a frame off, but the eye doesn't see a frame. One frame out, you know, when at 60 frames a second, one frame off, nobody cares. Nobody will see it. But basically, these things are synced in. And that got me thinking about, and I've been working on that for about 3 years. And then that got me thinking about this thing that we have of self-portraiture, of you know, constant selfie culture, of what are videos, what is interactive media, and I realized like we have less interactive media and less input in our media than we did when it was just television, because the television we could shut it off, and there wouldn't be any chance that when we turned the TV on, it would be the same thing. And we wouldn't, unless you know, the TV was rerunning. And so somebody else picked the program based on what they thought or what the data said people liked, which is very similar to, you know, to how, you know, the algorithm works, with the difference that we had to be there at the schedule of the TV versus you consume this media.
Yeah.
And so people have, you know, always talked about the dangers of television and mass media. I've realized that, like, mass media is just mass media. It's just, where is the time shifting? You know, what is the thing that's being served? And so I started a video series that was my old songs paired with a new painting, which I think you saw some of those.
Right. Yep.
And what I've done with those videos is I've put them in a television channel that loops based on that same start point, but I've also made it so that the television channels can actually be clicked through. There's a bunch of different videos, other videos that I've made through the years, and they're all on a predetermined calendar, a channel, you know, timer.
Yeah.
And so, again, any TVs showing this program will show the same video at the same frame at the same time.
Okay.
But you'll be able to change through the channel. You can change the channels and pick different videos.
Could I switch the channels as a viewer?
It's going to be just regular TVs. They're going to be embedded in regular TVs. It's going to be part of the performance. And I've been testing that, and I've gotten very good synchronization thanks to Thanks to some tricks I learned from a YouTuber named Jeff Geerling, who's a Raspberry Pi enthusiast, and he also got into being obsessed with time, and he mentioned some software in it. This little Linux time manager called Crony just lets you get within a microsecond. Within a millisecond of accuracy between two computers. So
wow.
I'm working on that right now, where I have a bunch of old analog TVs, a bunch of flat screen TVs, and I'm going to start embedding it, or hiding really mini PCs in the machines, so that people come into the space and they can pick the channel that they want to watch, but the programs are predetermined for them. But any 5-10 TVs will show the same content. You just get to pick the TV, and it's this thing of, like, TV has never been interactive, and what we have now is it's not interactive media, and it's even arguable that we're less interactive with the media that we consume now than we were 10 years ago, because companies used to answer emails, companies used to answer phones, celebrities used to be reachable, used to be able to send a message through, you know, snail mail. But now there's just so many people and so many trolls and so many that the media is just shut. So it's this sort of evolving conceptual idea about what is media, what is mass media, because that's been the thing that's shaped me the most. It's been it's the most important thing to me. I mean,
that goes against everything we think about modern day media, right? Because we all think we can interact, we can use it, we can in a way change it, we can change the program that is shown to us, but you say no, this is a closed world in a way.
It's totally.
So what's our role in this? I mean, we are just passive receptors in a way.
So if you think about it, if you think about the television, it's broadcast out to many, one voice to many.
Yep. Yep.
If you think about the telephone, it's one voice to one voice. Mm-hmm. Telegraph is, again, one voice to many. And so we had this feeling of many voices to many voices when things like Twitter happened, or YouTube, where anybody could be seen. But we're now back at that one voice to many, and maybe you'll have some feedback. But if you think, we don't get to pick what we see algorithmically. We don't get to pick. I'm a straight male who has no interest in looking at anything sexual on Instagram, but because physiologically my eyes held the frame twice as long when something sexy comes on, then even if I'm just scrolling through, Instagram for months was just showing me that stuff. And I don't care. I'm not offended. Yeah. But at the same time, it didn't matter how long I sat on my friends' Insta pages and looked at their stuff. Yeah. It was like, okay, in the ad content, this is the, and it would show me.
It's totally embarrassing when you get your phone and you want to show somebody something on Instagram and you push this, this little looking glass icon. And then all those, suggestions come up, and I always get my phone close to my body because I get there. I don't want anybody just, because everybody thinks I'm just watching porn on Instagram or whatever. It's disgusting in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not embarrassed because I know how the systems work.
Okay. So, but not everybody knows this.
I mean, I basically get pictures from Gaza and boobs.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, really, what I'm interested in is using these platforms to network and find similarly interested people, not people who have similar interests. Those two things are not things that are fundamental to my identity, and I can't find any of the things that are fundamental to my identity. This serves the purpose because you have in the old model 12 TV channels, and so everybody had the same time slot where they were watching probably the same thing, so you had things you could talk about. Now we have infinite number of TV channels showing basically the same content, but tailored such that the money goes into little different distribution streams, but ultimately the ad money all generates to the same 12 corporations anywhere. Actually, it's fewer corporations, like 6 corporations running everything these days, and so the content is no longer about creating a culture; it's about creating a revenue stream. Yeah. For the same interests that were creating the culture before.
Yeah.
And people are just completely delusional if they think that they have any influence. I mean, the least important people in the world are people who think that they have influence on social media. I mean, what do you have? Good example. I have 1,500 followers on Instagram. Or 1,400. One of the most famous voices of the art world has 100,000. Are you telling me that she only has 100 times more reach than me? She has infinitely more access to the world, to media, to she can make phone calls that will change people's lives. That's not 100 times more reach. That's 10,000, 100,000. So those numbers don't matter. And going the other way, you have influencers that have a million followers, and then they struggle to bring 10 people to an event that they're organizing.
Yeah,
So this is all, these numbers are all delusional. One thing that's really been helping me is every time I make a post, I look at my analytics. I made a post. It had the same picture with the same text 4 years ago before they changed things, had 900 likes.
Yeah.
12.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So what am I doing different aside from not paying as much, I'm not buying ads anymore, but that piece that got 12 or 15 likes was seen by 40 people. 40 people had eyes on it. Yeah. And so 25%, not exactly, but like a good chunk of people who saw my thing
liked it
and engaged.
Yeah.
And so I'm not doing anything wrong in that way. I'm not doing the thing that would get me more algorithmic view, and I don't want that. I don't need that. I want to continue to make art that matters to me. It might be the case that I would set up a separate stream that was entirely about engaging with the algorithm to have the real shit content. But at this point, I've realized that it's all pay to play. It's all nepotism. It's all who do you know, and since I wasn't born wealthy, my parents weren't famous artists, and I'm doing okay in terms of getting to know people. That's the only path, the path forward for me is continuously making things that interest me and hoping that when I put it out there, it interests somebody else.
Yeah.
It's very freeing, really. That realization that like what we do is just drops in the bucket, and because then you don't have to worry about offending, upsetting, boring people, because there's going to be very few people seeing it, and or if there are lots of people seeing it, you know that there will be people who like it. So
So
everything, the media landscape right now should be the most free it's ever been, the most experimental. We should be looking at like public access and music videos from the 1980s, and instead we're just seeing the sameness of culture because people have bought into this delusion that you have to that you have a chance of making it if you're like other people. And so it's fun. It's been, I'm making 12-minute long reels that have paragraphs of text, and that's not for my followers on Instagram. That's for me, so that when I put these projects together, I know what projects I'm working on. I have text that I can copy. I'm using these mediums as backup for my ideas that I would never put on my laptop.
It's a sort of archive.
Yeah, it's a total archive.
Which brings me to a painting of yours, which is called Just a Job.
Oh, yeah.
Just a Job, right? Yeah. Is it a recent painting, or did you do that?
2024. Yeah, 24, small format, 30 by 30 centimeters.
Right. It's again a mix of color, shapes, and words, like, you know,
I think this one's a lot more
the typical style.
I think this one's a lot more just text. I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's mostly text and some texture, really.
Is it a painting on your job as an artist, or?
Well, I mean, the thing about those I'm looking at it right now. The thing about these text heavy pieces, it's if you want to see it. By the way, it's the second to last, as of the time of that we're recording this, the second to the last on my under my posts. That was this one was probably looking at the sort of almost manic nature of the texts, because generally when things are really text heavy, it means I'm doing it all very quickly together because I was probably quite frustrated. I mean, in terms of artistically, not necessarily socially or intellectually.
That's where the title hints to, maybe.
Yeah. Just a joke. The naming structures don't necessarily reveal anything about the process, but because when it comes to naming stuff, it's materials or text or format, but because the phrase "just a job" is the most visible thing here, but
that's true, yeah.
But yeah, it's another piece that's playing a lot with text and language. There's a lot of deliberate misspellings, or not even deliberate, just uncorrected self, unreflected misspellings, the sort of noise generator of my brain, because I hate that in the past few years I've started making typos and spelling mistakes. And so I've allowed myself to do that more and more on canvas as a way of getting comfortable with the fact that, you know, I'm getting older and I don't have that super aspy power of perfect spelling anymore. And you know, 20
you
years.
You are autistic, right? Maybe we should say that. You're neurodivergent.
So, I'd say I'm pretty far gone.
just a job. You know, when I saw that, I mean, this is maybe just me, and maybe you never thought about that, but I thought that's you saying painting pictures is also just a job, and that goes against this this myth that the artist is somebody, in a way, very important person with a calling to, you know, bring the world whatever he or she thought of. And I found that refreshing, this approach to say, you know what I do is also just a job. Sometimes it's helped to just relax a little bit, but that was how I saw this. Maybe you never thought about that.
I mean, it's you know, there's another piece in the same series. It's further down. It says this costs extra on the text.
Yeah.
And so that this point that's pointing to is a hole in the canvas.
Right.
And so those were made around the same time, where really, yeah, there's sort of a commentary in built into those things talking about the thing. But I also don't want to get into that thing that comedians do where they're touring around and they're just talking about airplanes because that's all they know. I don't mind doing meta commentary, but I don't like doing work related meta commentary. And for these pieces, they were very specific about talking about the, not necessarily the art world, but any sort of endeavor that we're doing, really like treating it as just a job is okay. Doesn't matter. Self-mythologizing is the thing that gets people killed in medicine. Mm. It's the thing that leads to terrible art in art. It's the thing that leads to Volkswagen making terrible autos that nobody wants to work on. It's because, you know, if you treat it as just a job, that means your focus can really be on getting the job done. The just is doing a lot of heavy lifting because we think of just as only, but if it's just a job, then do just the job. There's definitely a lot of that going on and mm-hmm. absolutely, but it really, like, there was a feeling of, oh, yeah, maybe I should start taking this art thing more seriously, and maybe I should, you know, stop being so cynical about everything, and maybe I should start. And it's like, no. Then I'm doing the job wrong. I'm doing wrong by the job. I'm doing myself and everybody around me anytime. And that's not just for art. That's anything. Anything that I'm doing, I have to constantly tell myself, like, I'm not controlling the stars. I'm not really like if all life on Earth blinked out right now, nobody would notice because mm-hmm. because first off, we wouldn't be here to see it. And secondly, there's, you know, we're smaller than an atom in terms of universal scale. So, you know, in relative to our perception of an atom in terms of the universe, we're nothing. And so to blow myself up to epic sizes is deadly and also tedious. Nobody wants to talk to the guy who thinks that he's God's gift to art. I mean, nobody wants to look at that art, even though they have to pretend that they do because some big investor paid a bunch of money to have that piece of shit hidden in a museum that nobody wants to go to anyway.
True.
So that's. Okay, just spill water. And so those two pieces sort of serve a similar purpose. The one is talking about the mythologizing of damage and selling of trauma, and the other one is keeping things grounded.
Very good.
Yeah. Very good. I answered a question without ranting.
You did, and you did really good. Yes. I've got one last question for you.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a hard one. I don't know. But I'd like to know, where do you see yourself in 10 years? What do you think?
Well, I mean, if I can be here in 10 years, that's going to be an interesting thing because the world is changing so dramatically. Mm. What do I want to do in 10 years? That's the thing I struggle with a lot because every time I really have put everything into something, it feels like the universe, you know, kind of kicks the chair out from under me. In terms, I was an engineer. I was a theater student. I got very sick. I was an engineer. Germany took that from me. I started doing pretty well in social media. Algorithm changed. You know, what I can see is that I am going to continue developing work in a way that's true to myself. And what that medium will be, I can't predict because like every other, you know, neurodiverse person, it might be that the well just goes, nope, done here with this. And I have no input on that. But I haven't ever gone more than a few months or weeks or even days really without creating something new since I was basically a baby. And so I can't imagine that I'm not making something. Yep. Hopefully I'm making money. at that point, because I'll be 57 instead of 47, seven years away from forced retirement, or and I don't want to be a burden to my family as I age out of employability. So I would say my goals would be to have used that 10 years to develop some sort of financial stability, and that I've continued to work in a way that I can, you know, I can respect myself about, and that I'm reasonably sure I won't swing to the far right, that I won't embrace some sort of death cult sensibility.
There's
the horseshoe theory, and you always have to be careful of where you at, you know, which is why I was kind of...
Yeah, but the horseshoe theory is bullshit. I mean, it doesn't really work.
Well, you know, I mean, it's bullshit unless unless you sell essential oils or then it's not even really a horseshoe. It's just, what side of the crazy circle are you hanging out at?
True. I love that. Really, really good. Ben, thank you.
Goofy.
That was great.
Cool.
Thank you.
When are we going to start, by the way?
That was a great conversation. Thank you. And there was so much good stuff in that. I will have to think about that. Especially, you know, before we recorded, I was preparing in the bathroom, just, you know, washing my hands, went to the loo, whatever. And I was thinking, I don't know why I did that.
Why you wash your hands?
Yeah, why? No. I was thinking this, but I don't know why. If I would be away for just 1 month and I would paint every day, just, you know, from morning to evening, just painting every fucking day for 1 month, I believe there would be at least some quite good paintings coming out of that. And that was exactly what you said, you know, with this, you know, with this pottery example. I mean, do it, just keep doing and do it often, and then you will get somewhere. I like that very much. Yeah.
Do you know the Guess Who? The band, the Guess Who?
No.
These Eyes, American Woman Undone. Randy Bachman was in that band. They were considered one of the worst bands of all time when they were recording.
Yeah.
And now Randy Bachman is Oscar winner Randy Bachman. You know, you got a friend in me. You know, he's never stopped sucking, but he's become world famous for it. The Ramones were laughed off of stage for years, and then they're still terrible, but they were the Ramones. I mean, everything you do, you just do it, and you will get, it'll be your voice, but done to the state where you finally think you're doing it well.
Yeah.
There's, of course, the risk of delusion if you don't have some negative feedback. But I actually just taught a class for the first time over the past few weeks, past 8 to 9 weeks. I taught a painting like Giancarelli sort of class, which was 3 hours a day every Wednesday. And there were folks in there who had only ever painted in high school or painted with their with other classes that were similar. The works coming out were amazing. Like, the thesis was exactly what we talked about. Just paint. Don't put your, you know, you're not allowed to pick your materials. I'm picking your materials for you. I'm picking how many colors you can use. I'm telling you what techniques you use, but everything else is on you. And these people were coming out with just fantastic work, especially for people who had never painted before. And you stick with your limitations. You stick with respecting the process, and you're just going to end up with art. You're going to end up with material. You're going to end up with something. And if you do that over and over and over again, you're going to be better at it than the people who studied under somebody else who tried to shape them, because it's going to be you. And maybe it won't be of the specific level that the colonists say is masterful and you have to act like this, but it will be the best you that can be. And that's going to be way more interesting than someone who is a discount clone of some, you know, I mean, how many, what's that sculptor that everybody copies? Thomas Bierley? No, not Bierley. Volkenhoff. There's 50 of those guys, 50 knockoffs of that guy's work. floating around Frankfurt at any given time. And yeah. people are like, oh, it looks just like, it's like, okay, but that's not good. That's what we have Chinese clone farms for. You know, the thing that the AI revolution should have done was make people go, oh, okay, the only thing that can't get cloned is original content.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, people who make shitty knockoffs get upset because now their shitty knockoffs aren't as valuable as the AI-generated shitty knockoff. The people who don't care about that are people who are making original stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you just do it. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to dedicate a month to painting every day. That's too much pressure on yourself. But what you can do is piece of paper and a pen and just sketch. And then just get that muscle of creation going. At any time you feel like the moment you feel like you can't do it is the moment you have to. And that's the transition, because the can't do it, obviously if you have hand cramps or if you're just brain dead and you've been doing it a lot, but the moment that your brain saying you can't do that is a conditioned reflex, and that's when the good shit comes out. And so you can, I've seen your painting. You don't need a month of painting every day to get great. You're doing fine.
Oh, I was so frustrated just you know, recently. I thought, this is all crap. I mean, you have those times as well, don't you? Sometimes that you just think, what am I doing here? Or you don't?
No. I've been making shit. I've been making shit for 30 years. I mean, in like 30 years of people telling me, I don't understand what you're doing. I can think that this piece is shit. And I'm probably going to paint over it, or I'm going to throw it away, or whatever.
Okay.
But I look at the waveform of the work and the thing that saved my life was thing that saved me from ever having that worry was someone said to me, it's a cliche at this point, but really it really really saved my life, was don't record save two pieces of work, one from when you felt like you were the most inspired and doing the best work you ever did, and one from a day where you thought you had nothing in the tank. Put those side by side. Don't record which was which. Put them in a drawer and look at them in 6 months. You cannot tell the difference. You can't. Or worst case scenario, if you do log it, you find out that most of the time, not always, but most of the time, the shit you made when you thought you were flying high is of a lesser quality than the stuff that you had to convince yourself to keep going on.
Wow.
Because you are not a collector of your work. You're just the generator. You're just the you're the vessel. You're not the collector. Yeah, you're not the viewer. You are not the person to be judging your work.
Wow.
And 90% of people who do judge your work are, you know, on the which side of the give a shit scale are they anyway? I mean, you're like, we have 40%, 50% of the population right now voting for far right parties. Do you care what they think? No. And then of the 50% that aren't voting for far right parties, you have people who just are self, you know, even in that 50% are selfish assholes who have their heads so far up their ass that it doesn't matter. So you don't care what they think anyway. You're shooting for a specific audience that is inside that decent group of people. Hmm. And of that decent group of people, 90% of them don't give a shit about the same things that you give a shit about. So that's not for them. And then you're left with like 10% of people who might be interested. And those 10% of people have their own huge internal beautiful life like everybody else does. And so they might not see it. But at huge expanded numbers, there's going to be somebody who sees your work and thinks, that's the best thing I ever saw in my life. And you might think, I almost burned that. And you know how I know this? From specific personal experience. That piece that you took, Uli hates. Like,
really?
Hates.
Really? Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people did. My wife, who's
hanging
my biggest...
here on my wall, just there.
Yeah. Watch the gesture. But...
I'm sorry.
My wife, who's my biggest fan, biggest collector, like, you know, she's organized tons of my shows and she loves my work. She hates certain pieces of mine.
Yeah.
And I hate other pieces of mine.
Yeah.
And neither of us are the people who should be judging that because we're too close to it.
Right.
And so like every piece that you make, as long as you know, make sure you actually work through your what are my criteria for doneness? What are my criteria for quality? Every piece that you make could be somebody's favorite. And if you filter out who you think should give a shit about it, then you realize like there's just a very small, the lack of people caring is not necessarily a reflection of the quality of your work. It could really just be that you're not getting in front of the right eyes. And yeah, I simplified things by breaking people into left and right quadrants. That's not true. Everybody is, we all exist in multitudes, but really like for simplification purpose, just shrink down who you think might be interested in your shit. And one thing that's really cool is if you spend enough time around people who are interested in your stuff that have no reason to be interested in your stuff other than that they're there, random people, you can start to think in an empathetic way of what makes them feel that way about your work, and you can start gauging that work by that quality. Mm. And it reduces the stress. And so that's why I don't worry about this stuff. Like, I mean, I have moments where I don't want to make art because it's not financially or socially rewarding, and I'm around people that I'm embarrassed to be around sometimes. There are moments where I think like, why would I give a shit about this medium, which is completely controlled by the most boring people in the world? But I keep, you know, I mean, but then I look at every medium and realize that we're at the peak of nepotism and the peak of you know, vitamin B, as they call it here. And but that shit has never bothered me. It didn't bother me when I was making noise projects for a known audience of 120 people through the whole world. Mm-hmm. Why would it matter to me that now that I'm operating on a slightly bigger scale? And mm-hmm. you know, I mean, and frankly, like the art world is smaller than any other creative medium. Like this fine art world, it just feels bigger because it's more diffuse, and it has the leftover stink from the CIA, you know, having promoted it for so many years. Like people,
that's
the older
another
generation,
story. Yeah, yeah. We should
the
talk
older,
about
older
that
generation
yeah.
has deluded themselves into thinking that this shit that we do matters.
It doesn't.
Nothing matters. Nothing matters. Art doesn't matter. The person matters, and the audience matters. Mm. And our job is just to. It's to get the right eyes in front of the right piece, and that thing that we make can change someone's entire existence. And it doesn't mean that because you made it, you are someone who can change someone's existence. It's just as a human, we filter all this shit out and put it out there, and then there's going to be someone who, at that moment, it could be a smile, it could be a painting. Someone needs that thing from you, and that's the most beautiful part of it. That's what keeps me going, is mm-hmm. knowing that there's just a little bit of a. Making the world a little bit better for having done that thing. And that's how you can kind of stay humble while also just being incredibly arrogant about your importance in the world.
Great.
Yeah.
I hope you took notes, everybody. That, yeah. Really, this is great. I'm glad we recorded this. I will listen to this. I mean, I will have to because I have to edit this. But, you know, that was lots of good things for me in that too. Thank you, Ben. Thank you
for
this great conversation. Yeah. Are you into Game of Thrones at all? A little bit?
No.
No. We have we talked about rituals just a few minutes ago. We have a ritual at the end of every episode. Somebody says in German, was sagen wir dem Tod? And the other one says, nicht heute.
Okay.
Could we do that, or is it too embarrassing for you?
That's fine.
You think it's childish?
Childish? No. Not at all. I don't think that rituals or things that matter to people are ever childish. Children make the best rituals. I mean,
it's true.
Yeah.
It's a bit. Well, okay. I wanna hear you say it. Was sagen wir dem Tod?
Nicht heute.
Nicht heute.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ben Giancarelli, everybody. You can find we will put the links into the show notes of your Instagram channel and your website, so everybody can find you and your works and whatever you do.
Yeah, and come if you're in the Frankfurt area. I have a great studio. It's quite comfortable and has cool video shit going on right now.
Oh, great!
Yeah,
great. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Danke an euch alle. Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir hören uns das nächste Mal wieder. Da werden dann Marco und Jay wieder mit dabei sein. Und wir reden mit Johnny vom Dahl, einem Musiker, der eine ziemlich große Pleite mit Instagram erlebt hat. Instagram hat seinen Videokanal einfach gelöscht. Einfach jetzt, von jetzt auf gleich. Und er hat Meta verklagt und hat seinen Instagram-Channel irgendwann wiederbekommen. Und er wird uns diese Geschichte erzählen. Und wir werden auch wieder über Social Media reden und über die Frage... wie das mit Kunst, also Social Media und Kunst, wie gut oder wie schlecht das eigentlich zusammengeht oder nicht. Da bin ich sehr gespannt drauf. Genau. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Macht es gut. Ciao, ciao.
Vielen Dank, dass du zugehört hast. Wir hoffen, dass es dir gefallen hat. Wenn du uns ein bisschen helfen möchtest, dann kannst du diese Folge in den sozialen Netzwerken teilen. Twitter, Facebook, du weißt schon. Oder vielleicht schreibst du uns sogar eine Rezension bei iTunes. Das würde auch sehr helfen. Und wenn du uns so richtig doll helfen möchtest, dann kannst du über eine finanzielle Unterstützung nachdenken. Du findest auf cobainserben.de raus, wie das geht. Hoffentlich bist du das nächste Mal wieder dabei. Wir würden uns total freuen. Bis dahin, mach's gut. Tschüss.